American commitments abroad broadly, and he is reportedly even asked about withdrawing U.S. troops from Europe. There are still tens of thousands of American troops in Germany, have been since World War II. Could that be done? Could that be safely done, a withdrawal of U.S. forces from Europe?
I think it'd be a mistake, and let's put it in context, Steve. At the height of the Cold War, we had 400,000 troops in Europe. Today, we have only 35,000. It's a 95% drop. Those troops are stationed there not only to provide deterrence against Russia, but they also operate forward into Afghanistan, the Middle East. Those are forward bases for us. We're lucky to have them. 35,000 is a reasonable troop presence.
Let me ask another question now, because this summit is coming up, and afterward, President Trump is planning to meet Russia's President Putin in Helsinki, Finland. Goodness knows there is a lot to discuss. But as we approach this, the president has taken Russia's side in the dispute over how much Russia interfered in the U.S. election. He has made remarks suggesting that Crimea, which Russia seized from Ukraine, is actually part of Russia, although U.S. policy apparently remains the same. We could make a list of remarks and statements and actions of the president. Do you, Admiral, have confidence that the president of the United States is working in the interest of the United States as opposed to in the interest of Russia?
Well, in this particular instance, when we look exactly at the list you have articulated, Steve, I'm worried. And in particular, I'm worried about falling back on Crimea. This was a land grab by Russia, an annexation. We've not seen a sovereign nation carve a chunk out of another sovereign nation with force of arms since the Second World War. So I'd hate to see the president fall off on that. I'd hate to see him fall off on exercises in Europe the way he's fallen off on exercises in South Korea. I think there's a lot to worry about in terms of where the president lands on this, and he needs to have his experts in the room with him and not do this meeting one-on-one with Vladimir Putin. That's a real mistake.
Isn't there a plan for them to meet one-on-one, or a desire for them to meet one-on-one anyway?
There very much is, and that ought to concern us, because at the end of the day, with only the two presidents in the room, we don't have ground truth. We don't have an absolute articulation of what passes between the two of them. That's not good in international relations. I want to see Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in the room with the president, along with Sergey Lavrov, his opposite number in the Russian Federation. We need that. They need that kind of support.
Now, whatever concerns people might have, there are people outside of the administration, experts outside the administration, saying these two countries aren't getting along, but they do need to meet. There's a lot to discuss. What is one legitimate thing that really needs to be on the table that the two presidents really do need to discuss at this time?
I'll give you three. One is cybersecurity, and that is bigger than election interference. That's Russia and the United States in a shadow war. Got to stop that. We've got to come together on Afghanistan if we're going to solve that. And above all, the two presidents need to talk about avoiding a Cold War, a new Cold War. There's a lot on that table between them.
Okay, Admiral, thanks very much. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Steve. Happy 4th. Be good.
Enjoy the holiday. Admiral James Stavridis was Supreme Allied Commander of NATO.
Come November, voters in New Mexico could elect the country's first Native American woman to Congress. Deb Haaland is one of a record number of Native Americans running for statewide and federal office this year. NPR's Leila Fadel has the story.
I'm just reaching out to you today to let you know that we won our primary election.
On a recent afternoon, Deb Haaland sits with a thick stack of paper in front of her, calling donors to thank them and to ask for more money for her run in November. After winning her primary, Haaland, a member of the Pueblo of Laguna, is running for the U.S. House in a strongly Democratic district in New Mexico. Now, she's not new to politics. She's the former chair of the state's Democratic Party. This year, Haaland ran because of President Trump's policies, but also
I identified with so much of what people go through in this district and in this state. Half of our population is Medicaid eligible. There's a lot of single moms. So many people are paying off their student loans.
She's a single mom, went to public schools, lived on food stamps, and she's cast herself as a working class candidate.
I just feel like, I don't know, this is the year. A lot happened, right, this year. Maybe we just all said separately, it's time for us to, you know, take the next step.
When she says all, she means the record number of Native American women running who could become first themselves. Not all of them will win this fall, but the sheer number matters, says Mark Trahant. He's the editor of the website Indian Country Today, and he's been counting Native American candidates for the last 6 years.
There really is a record year this year. It's extraordinary. You see folks running for such a variety of offices.
There are two Native American men in Congress right now, both Republican. But the list of candidates this year has grown. Trahant expects as many as 10 Native Americans will be on the congressional ballot this fall, double the number in 2016. As for statewide offices, there are more Native Americans running for lieutenant governor alone, six candidates, than the number that ran for statewide offices across the country in 2016. Trahant says some of this is a reaction to the current political climate, but it's also the fruit of years of work by Native American organizers and politicians. And the candidates, he says, are dismantling stereotypes with campaigns that show the diversity of Indian country. There's Tatewi Means, who recently lost a primary for attorney general in South Dakota, but had a groundbreaking political ad. It was in Lakota, which Trahant says is the first time he's seen a political ad in a native language. There's also Charisse Davids, a lesbian ex-MMA fighter who's running for Congress in Kansas.
It's 2018, and women, Native Americans, gay people, the unemployed and underemployed have to fight like hell just to survive.
She wears a t-shirt that reads strong, indigenous, and resilient as she pounds a punching bag. Again, Trahant.
I think what's important about those ads is it will change people's perceptions about Native Americans in general, not just the political campaigns, but how people perceive the Native community.
It's galvanizing indigenous voters who are often sidelined by voting laws and distrustful of a government that has taken so much from them.
Congratulations, guys!
Oh, thank you so much.
That's clear when walking around with Deb Haaland in Albuquerque. All kinds of people walk up to congratulate her on her primary win. But it's different when the supporter is indigenous. At a minor league baseball game, Robert Piper greets her.
As a Native Hawaiian, I'm very proud of you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Following your race.
One of Haaland's interns gets emotional as she explains why she's working on the campaign. Deshae Gray is Navajo.
I see, like, my family in her family. And I think that's something that's really important that I've never seen before. Sorry, it's just, like, really emotional to me because it means so much.
There's a lot of energy around this year's crop of candidates. But the question is, will that translate into more Native Americans showing up at the polls? Historically, indigenous voters have had some of the lowest turnout rates of any group in the country. Layla Fawzin, NPR News, Albuquerque.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:18. You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. Just ahead, we have headlines from NPR. And then in one small town in Russia, three generations of soccer players take on the meaning of the sport and the World Cup in their backyard. NPR reporter Alina Selyud takes us there in about 7 minutes. Stay with us.
Support for WGTD comes from the Racine Zoo. Kick off summer with Wine, Stein, and Dine. June 30th from 6 to 9 p.m. for adults 21 and over. Explore the zoo, enjoy unlimited samples of wine and beer, and bites of local cuisine. For more info, visit racinezoo.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support musical and cultural connections. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Senate Intelligence Committee is out with a report on its investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Here's NPR's Giles Snyder.
The Senate panel agrees with the assessment by the CIA, the FBI, and the National Security Agency that the Russian government preferred Donald Trump and worked to influence the vote in 2016. The committee's Republican chairman says there is no reason to dispute their findings. The committee is still looking into any possible collusion, which President Trump fiercely denies.
On this July 4th holiday, firefighters are battling more than 60 large wildfires in nearly a dozen states in the western U.S. They include California, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, and Colorado. Hundreds of additional police officers are patrolling the streets of Chicago in hopes of preventing a repeat of last year's holiday violence. NPR's David Schaefer reports.
Shootings across Chicago killed 14 people and wounded nearly 100 others over the long 4th of July holiday weekend last year, despite a beefed-up police presence. So this year, authorities are dispatching even more law enforcement officers. 1,500 extra Chicago cops are on the street. The state police is adding extra officers, too, as is the FBI, DEA, and the ATF.
According to the Chicago Tribune, police say 23 people were shot in the city last weekend. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Communities in Dane County that want to connect local bike trails to the county system can get funding to help pay for those trail projects. A program called PARC, Partners for Recreation and Conservation and Ride Grant Program, will provide up to 50% of a project's cost to local communities to help offset the cost of bike trail design, engineering, and construction. Dane County Executive Joe Parisi tells the State Journal the grant program is now accepting applications for the $500,000 in grant funding included in the 2018 county budget. The grant applications are due by October 1st. The State Democratic Party's Veterans Caucus will hold a forum later this month featuring five of the party's gubernatorial candidates. The party announced yesterday that the caucus would host a two-hour forum at the Madison Labor Temple on July 14th. Five of the eight Democratic gubernatorial candidates have confirmed they will attend, including Josh Pade, Kelda Royes, Malon Mitchell, Matt Flynn, and Mike McCabe. Each candidate will be asked three questions and given 2 minutes to respond. Each candidate also will be allowed a three-minute closing statement. Tony Evers, Kathleen Vinehout, and Paul Soglin also are vying for the Democratic nomination. You can expect highs today in the 80s and lower 90s. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing. Account registration and more at zoom.us. From the Craig Newmark Foundation, committed to the values of fairness, opportunity, and respect, the Newmark Foundation supports veterans and military families, voting rights, truth and journalism, and women in tech. From Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. Today is the 4th of July. It's a chance to celebrate being American. So a couple of our producers here went down to the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and they asked people visiting the Lincoln Memorial on a very hot afternoon what it means to be American. Here's what they had to say.
My name's Tara Gallis, and I'm from Kokomo, Indiana. My dad was an immigrant to America and came here from Egypt because he was denied the opportunity to be a pharmacist because of his religion. And America means to me the opportunity to be a pharmacist or be whatever you want to be and not denied that because of your race or religion or social status.
My name is Shravanti Barua, and I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. To me, being American means knowing that our soldiers are working hard to keep us safe.
I'm Brian Truckee. I'm from Hawaii, and I'm also a staff sergeant in the United States Army. We really stand up for values that when something is wrong, we stand together, say this is wrong, and we fight that impurity in the system.
My name is Karen Thomason, and I'm from Brownsburg, Indiana. And I'm proud to be an American. The ability to go to church when I want to be able to serve God when I want to. Just seeing the American flag makes me cry.
My name is Nancy Gutierrez, and I live in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Being an American to me means being inclusive, celebrating people's differences, being welcoming, but I feel like there's really been a negative shift
and those core values that I think that are really fundamentally American.
Oh, I'm Rebecca Dahlgren. I'm from San Ramon, California. I'm just honored to be an American, and I get emotional. Sorry. It's really upsetting, at least to me it is, when people have said they're ashamed to be Americans. I don't understand that. It makes me sad. Because you live here, be proud to live here.
I'm Annabelle Farrington with my children and my niece, and we're from Orlando, Florida. I'm a green card holder. I'm not an American citizen. I'm originally from the Bahamas. The opportunities that I have embraced here, I could never embrace in my country. The opportunity to adopt two wonderful children and to see them grow and flourish and to feel love. The opportunity to worship freely. I'm a Christian. The opportunity to meet people from all over the world. All the things that you can embrace in America, it's unbelievable. And this country will always be blessed.
Some of the voices on the National Mall. Now at the World Cup in Russia, one group of fans is watching with special interest, Russians who play soccer as well as watch it. NPR's Alina Selyuk grew up in Russia and is covering the World Cup. She spoke with three generations of Russian soccer players, starting with her own family.
My father parks the car in front of a five-story apartment building. Mm-hmm. Red brick, balconies jutting out. He says that window on the first floor, that was his room as a kid. I immediately see the stadium. It's directly across the street.
Mom would send me off to do homework, but I go quietly to the window, hop, and off to the stadium.
It was hockey in the winter, soccer in the summer, though, of course, my father would call it football. This was the 60s in the Soviet Union. And today, my dad, his name is Alexander, by the way, he brought me back to his hometown of Otradny, population 50,000, to meet one of his best friends from childhood. His name is also Alexander Purgaev. He grew up one door down. Together with my dad in the 70s, he joined the town's soccer team. And Purgaev, he's still on it. Well, he's the coach. His office has two birds in hanging cages and trophies and plaques propped up everywhere there's a flat surface. His team is one of the best in the region. His players occasionally go on to professional leagues. Here in Otradny, the players do get paid, but they're amateurs with other day jobs. Except for Purgaev, for whom soccer is the day job.
Football is my life. It's everything. For a long time now, all my family has understood. My wife and kids, they know. They used to say, you and your football. But now they say, dad is at work.
Purgaev says their town soccer games draw all kinds of people, up to 1,000 in the stands. A lot of retired men, sure, but also girls and moms with children. Plus, soccer is also more accessible to play. It doesn't require expensive equipment, just some shoes and a patch of dirt. It's just something you do as a kid, during recess in school, with friends in the yard, or in today's case, on a fancy soccer field. Here in the stadium on one side, there's a cluster of tiny children, maybe 5 or 6 years old, kicking the ball around. On another side, a tall man towers over a squad of teenagers. His name is Valery Kruntsev. He plays on Purgaev's adult team and also trains this youth lineup, which is where he got his own start back in the day.
I remember when I was little, we had a shortage of players and our coach went to different schools and talked to boys trying to convince them to come to practice. But now we don't have such a problem. We might get 30, 40, even 50 people coming. Everyone wants to train.
Kruntsev had left Otradny to attend football academies and play semi-pro and pro for a while, got an education degree, and came back to train the next generation of players. Amir Tabarov draws the short straw to have to talk to the reporter lady. He is 14, and so are most of his teammates, one of whom is actually a girl. I ask him to name his favorite players.
Ronaldinho.
Brazil's Ronaldinho.
Cristiano Ronaldo.
Second place is Portugal's Cristiano Ronaldo. And third place,
my brat.
His brother, who plays on the town's adult men's team, together with the youth coach, Kruntsev. From where the teenagers are playing today, it's about 50 miles to the Samara Arena, one of the stadiums hosting this year's World Cup. The youth team was actually in the drawing to be ball boys for the tournament, but didn't get in. Coach Kuntsev is wearing a World Cup t-shirt. He says he's been using the matches as material for training and has even overheard the little preschoolers discussing the games.
You watch TV and think it's like a parallel universe that you'll never see or know, except on TV. But here you realize they're real, and here they are in Samara. You can go there and see.
The boys on the youth team told me they're feeling motivated by the World Cup, wanting to be on the Russian team when the next one rolls around. Amir Tabarov points out they'll be 18 by then. Alina Selyuk, NPR News, Samara, Russia.
This is NPR News.
When immigrants become American citizens, it's considered a permanent change. Now, the Trump administration is launching a task force to identify cheaters and strip them of that citizenship.
The last time the federal government tried to denaturalize citizens was during the McCarthy period.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the Trump administration's effort to find citizenship scammers. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. It is 8:30 on this 4th of July. You're with us for Morning Edition here on WPR. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. Three words for you. Wood Tick Race. It's a thing, really. We travel to the 39th annual Wood Tick Race in northern Wisconsin in about 15 minutes. In Wisconsin news, Wisconsin's Revenue Department is reporting nearly 560,000 families applied for the governor's $100 child tax rebate before Monday's deadline. State officials estimated about 670,000 families were eligible. The rebates will be paid before school starts next fall through direct deposit or a check in the mail. Wisconsin will offer a sales tax holiday on school supplies, clothing, computers, and computer supplies between August 1st and August 5th. A Wapaka County judge has sentenced a 28-year-old man to 8 years in prison for causing a house explosion, which injured two men. Jonathan Ryer had been renting the house from a former girlfriend when he learned he was being evicted. Ryer had pleaded no contest to two charges of second-degree recklessly endangering safety and battery. Douglas Rogenbauer and Adrian Gibbs were taken to a Milwaukee burn center with serious injuries after the July 2016 blast. Ryer was accused of damaging the home, which caused the gas leak. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for WPR comes from the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton, presenting Gridiron Glory, the best of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, featuring a tribute to the Green Bay Packers' 100th anniversary. MyHistoryMuseum.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Frank's Diner, the diner your mother warned you about. Order what you want, eat what you get. Reservations for parties five or more, call 262-697-1017. Franks Diner, Kenosha.com.
Statewide, partly cloudy with heat advisories in place for southern and western Wisconsin. Storms popping up this afternoon in the central and southern parts of the state. Then late tonight, strong storms developing over northern Wisconsin, spreading across the state. You can expect highs today in the 80s and lower 90s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the New York Times. It takes facts to fully understand the issues shaping the U.S. and the world. New York Times journalists are committed to exploring stories from every angle. From the Alliance for Lifetime Income, a nonprofit composed of financial services organizations working to educate Americans about options for securing protected lifetime income in retirement. More at allianceforlifetimeincome.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. President Trump is undoing another act of his predecessor. The Trump administration is withdrawing Obama-era guidelines that encourage schools to promote racial diversity through their admissions processes. The Departments of Justice and Education said yesterday that they have retracted a set of letters and memos that advise schools and colleges on how they could consider race to diversify their campuses. NPR's Sarah McCammon has been covering this story. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
All right, so these Obama-era guidelines were just that. They were guidelines. They were not laws. But this withdrawal by the Trump administration, what does that tell us about this administration's priorities?
Well, obviously, it reflects a broader philosophical disagreement about affirmative action and the use of race in admissions. And the Justice Department was already probing schools over how they do that. But also, it's in line with the Trump administration's view that President Obama relied too much on these kinds of guidance documents that the Trump administration is pulling back from. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said in a statement that they're used to circumvent the rulemaking process. And he says the Justice Department has identified 24 guidance documents to repeal this month on a number of issues, including home loans, fair employment, refugees' right to work, and other topics. So affirmative action is getting a lot of attention, but this is part of a longer list of Obama-era guidance that the Trump administration is stepping away from.
Oh, that's interesting. So there are a long list of things there. The fight over affirmative action in particular is not new. This has been going on for decades. What has the reaction been so far to this move?
Well, there's controversy about it, obviously, on both sides. Affirmative action has been a contentious issue for a very long time. It tends to be supported more by people on the left who see it as important to encouraging diversity. On the right, it's seen sometimes as unfair, and that continues to be a debate that's played out for a very long time.
The timing here is really interesting because affirmative action is one of a handful of really important issues that could be revisited by a conservative Supreme Court. And the president, as we know, has spent this week interviewing nominees to fill a vacancy left by Anthony Kennedy's retirement. What do we know about how that process is going?
Yeah, the White House says the president continues to meet with potential candidates. And President Trump talked about the process last night at a veterans event in West Virginia.
These are very talented people, brilliant people, and I think you're going to really love it, like Justice Gorsuch. We hit a home run there, and we're going to hit a home run here. And step by step, we are making America great again.
And of course, Neil Gorsuch was his first pick to the Supreme Court, and he has been very popular with the base, with social conservatives. Another pick like Gorsuch would face a lot of pushback from Democrats, given that Justice Kennedy was the swing vote, and that would tilt the balance of the court much more in favor of conservatives on a number of issues. And it's worth mentioning, Noelle, that President Trump made those comments in West Virginia last night. That is the home state of Senator Joe Manchin, who's one of those red state Democrats we've been hearing about so much, facing re-election, voted for Gorsuch, and is going to face pressure to vote for Trump's nominee.
I know there are a lot of rumors flying around out there, but do we have any specifics on who the president is considering for this post in the Supreme Court?
We've heard in the last day or so that he's now spoken to 7 prospective nominees. At least one is a woman, Amy Coney Barrett. She's getting a lot of attention in part because most of the candidates are men. Mm-hmm. Other names we're hearing are also appeals court judges like Brett Kavanaugh and Amul Thapar. We know that the president spoke to Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who's indicated an openness to be considered for the position. He's been on a longer list of potential nominees, but it's not clear he's on the short list or that he's even being seriously considered. The short list does seem to be getting a little bit longer all the time, but we should know the nominee by Monday.
And just briefly, how are Democrats reacting to the names that are floating around out there?
They're pushing back. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is calling for a moderate pick in the tradition of Justice Kennedy. So we'll see.
NPR's Sarah McCammon. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Hundreds of Central American migrant parents are still trying to figure out where their children are and how to reunite with them. Some 2,000 children or more were separated from parents when they crossed the border. Last week, a federal judge ordered that they all be reunited with their parents within a month. Tyke Hendricks of our member station KQED has been following one family's efforts to recover their child, and KQED reporter Alex Hall follows up.
Nazario crossed the U.S.-Mexico border east of San Diego with his 5-year-old daughter Filemona in mid-May. Nazario is a farmer from a village in northern Guatemala. We aren't using his last name to protect his family because they've been threatened by gangs. Nazario and his daughter were detained by Border Patrol. He asked for asylum. In a court declaration, Nazario said Filemona was taken out of his arms by the Border Patrol agents. Both he and his daughter were screaming and crying, he said. While Nazario was detained in San Diego, he did not know where his daughter had been taken. His public defender, James Chavez, tracked the little girl down in New York. Chavez spoke to a caseworker who had visited Filomena.
She just described a little girl who was crying every day, who was missing her father very much, which paralleled him crying every day and missing his little girl.
Nazario was prosecuted for illegally entering the U.S. He abandoned his request for asylum in the hopes it would improve his chances of being reunited with his daughter.
My impression of Nazario is that he was deeply depressed, maybe even broken.
2 weeks ago, immigration agents put Nazario on an airplane and deported him back to Guatemala. We reached him by phone on Tuesday. He says he last talked to his daughter by phone late last week. He says Filomena can't even talk. She cries. She's upset with her parents. Nazario says he hasn't received any information from U.S. authorities about his daughter. His main point of contact has been the Guatemalan consulate. It's been nearly 2 months since he saw his daughter, he says. He has no idea when she's coming back. The consulate has told him to be patient. He says his patience is running out. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hall in San Diego.
It's NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:41 on a Wednesday. Glad you're with us on this 4th of July. News headlines are just ahead from NPR and WPR. Later this hour, the Battle Hymn of the Republic was written as a rousing anthem for the Union in the Civil War. Since then, it's been caught up in a cultural tug of war over who it's an anthem for: social conservatives, evangelical Christians, labor workers, or civil rights leaders. The meaning behind the music coming up in 10 minutes here on WPR.
WPR has been on the air since 1917, a pioneer in the development of radio. A lot has happened since then, and listener support is the foundation. You've helped us expand access with stations all over the state and the WPR app, and you've helped provide informative and enjoyable content on three networks and the web. You've made our remarkable history possible, and you carry us into the future. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. From Southern California to Southern New England, heat advisories are posted on this July 4th holiday. The National Weather Service says Phoenix could see 104 degrees this afternoon. The Trump administration says the federal government will no longer encourage colleges and universities to consider a student's race in their admissions decisions. The Obama-era guidance was meant to promote enrollment diversity. Kristen Clark is with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law.
It sends a message that the federal government doesn't believe in racial diversity, and we run the risk that we may see school officials going back to the drawing board, revising their policies and changing their approach in ways that can be really harmful to us as a country.
The Justice Department describes the guidance as unnecessary and inconsistent with existing law. The president of Poland's Supreme Court is fighting her forced retirement. Here's NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson.
Polish Chief Justice Małgorzata Gajstow had been told to step down at midnight, but she refused. She calls her dismissal and that of nearly half the others on her court a purge. But the government claims the justices' retirements are aimed at fighting corruption and improving judicial efficiency. Its actions against the Polish judiciary have sparked major protests in Warsaw in support of the justices.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just in time for the 4th of July in peak tourist season, lakes around Wisconsin are seeing outbreaks of toxic blue-green algae. The algae can cause rashes, diarrhea, or even kill pets. That's according to the State Department of Natural Resources' Gina LaLiberty. She's the agency's algae coordinator.
People and pets could be affected if they accidentally swallow water, or in the case of people, if they're inhaling water droplets containing blue-green algae while they're, say, water skiing or tubing across a bloom. Those toxins can cause illness.
La Liberty says the algal blooms have occurred a bit earlier than normal due to hot weather. Several beaches in Madison have been closed due to algae, and blooms have been noted on Lake Winnebago. An administrative law judge in Minnesota has dealt a setback to a proposed gas-fired power plant in Superior. Minnesota Power wants to join with La Crosse-based Dairyland Power Cooperative to build the plant, saying it would provide backup for wind energy that the Minnesota utility is adding to its system. But Judge Gene Cochran this week recommended that the Public Utilities Commission deny the request, saying Minnesota Power failed to prove the plant is needed. Minnesota Public Radio is reporting that several clean energy groups oppose the project, saying approving the fossil fuel plant would make it impossible for Minnesota to meet its emission targets. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which provides unrestricted support to individual artists in jazz, dance, and theater through the Doris Duke Artist Awards.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Wisconsin, where it's the ticks that do the racing. Michelle Good went to check it out.
Hi. Is this the registration desk?
Yeah. By insects.
I'm at North Country's Hardwood Cafe in Loretta, Wisconsin, about halfway between Park Falls and Hayward. And I'm staring at a stack of little takeout condiment cups, each one with a wood tick inside. I will never look at tartar sauce the same way again.
I didn't realize you could... You buy the tick?
Yes, you can buy the tick for $1, or you can bring your own and you just have to pay to register it.
I'm Terry.
Terry.
Okay, my name is this Tic Tac.
Okay, there was one more with you.
That's Doug. Your tick's name is?
Jezebel.
Jezebel?
Where did you find it?
Just walk outside.
Heck yeah.
Just walk
all
over. Look at them all over here.
And it's much more competitive than you would expect.
There was a guy there that I was talking to. He got a tick off his dog, and he took it off for a couple days. Then he would put it on for a couple days and take it off for a couple days.
So yeah. Training regimen.
Yes.
It's the steroids. It's tick racing.
Thank you, everybody, for the green Susies to keep the wood tick racing tradition in order. First two ticks are Waylon and Tristan. Two on deck are Speedy and French Tickler. Waylon and Christine, are we ready?
Oh my God, so they plop them down.
And they're off.
You know whose is whose?
Yeah, that's yours.
Well, that's going to win.
Come on. Oh, here goes. Oh, boy.
Christine is fast.
Waylon's drunk.
Waylon's just walking in a circle.
He hasn't even got out of circles.
There, now you're going the right way.
Christine's nearly back to where she started.
Just get mine out of the circle.
He's still in the circle.
Just get out of the circle.
Oh, Christine's making a move. Oh, no, she's going back to help Waylon. Not sure where to go.
This is the longest race in the history of the
United States. Oh, here it goes, here it goes.
Speedy and French tick.
Oh, and there's one dead tick. Oh my God, there's a loose one.
Somebody picked their winning tick. Speedy, we're looking for Speedy.
These people are not in control. You don't want to mix alcohol and ticks.
I'd just like to say that for the record.
Okay, they said a couple years ago it was like 120.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had quite a few. We had quite a few. Yeah. I mean, the bar was absolutely
hard to wrangle that many ticks.
Right. Yeah. But a dollar entry, winner takes all, so you usually walk away about $45, $50.
Yeah.
That's big, nice. Big nice time. Saturday.
Big money in the Northway. A couple beers. Yeah.
Yeah. Can't go wrong.
Yep. I mean, what else are you going to do right before the holiday weekend, Dan? You know? So it's always something to do. We always have fun up here.
They certainly do. After 3.5 hours of racing and 42 dead ticks, Scott Scooter Smith of New Richmond took home the trophy with his tick, Bloodsucker.
Michelle Good grew up in the Northwoods and is the host of Chapter a Day. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Wisconsin Live taking us to all the nooks and crannies of the state and covering competition of the highest order. It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. The classical music starts in 15 minutes with your host, Stephanie Elkins. But stay with us. There's more Morning Edition ahead here on WPR.
Celebrate summer and support WPR at Crayfish Summerfest, a one-of-a-kind dining experience at Al Johnson's Restaurant in Door County. Hi, I'm Maureen McCollum. Join Lori Skelton and me on August 16th for traditional Swedish food and drink, including crayfish, summer vegetables, and strawberry cardamom shortbread, along with live music and good friends. That's Crayfish Summerfest at Al Johnson's in Sister Bay. Get tickets and details at WPR.org/presents.
Muggy statewide, partly cloudy with heat advisories in place for southern and western Wisconsin. Storms popping up this afternoon over the central and southern parts of the state. And then late tonight, strong storms developing over northern Wisconsin. Expect highs today in the 80s and lower 90s.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like the Widener Center for the Performing Arts and Essentia Health play a huge role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, featuring fruit vendors from Michigan, Dad's Farm, and Churchill Orchards. Churchill already has cherries, blueberries, and raspberries. Coming soon, peaches and other stone fruits. The market is open Saturdays from 9 until 2.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. Today we're starting a new series called American Anthem. We're exploring songs that tap into the collective emotions that listeners and performers have around an issue or a belief.
And we start with a big one, a big anthem, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Now there's an episode of a Johnny Cash show from 1969 where the man is about to sing that song, but before he starts, he makes a little speech with a pretty big error.
Here's a song that was reportedly sung by both sides in the Civil War.
The history is clear. The Battle Hymn was first written by Julia Ward Howe as a pro-Union, anti-slavery song. But then Cash makes this point.
Which proves one thing to me, that a song can belong to all of us. You know.
And about that, he's right.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
NPR's Andrew Limbong guides us through one of America's most enduring anthems.
I should go easy on Johnny Cash for flubbing the history of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I had it wrong, too. I didn't even know the song had ties to the Civil War up until embarrassingly recently. Because I, and maybe you, if you grew up with a similar flavor of Christianity, only sang it at church. Little did I know, the song was being used to root for college football teams, go Georgia, as an anthem for labor unions, evangelist Billy Graham, who helped popularize the song among Christians, even took it to the Russian Army chorus in 1992.
It's a good march. I mean, it's just the right cadence to march along if you're marching in a picket line or marching down the street carrying signs.
That's Sparky Rucker, a folk singer and Civil War historian who performs a show of Civil War music called Blue and Gray in Black and White with his wife Rhonda.
It sets your heart to and really gets your blood going, and that you can slay dragons.
Dragons are relative, though. Anita Bryant used to sing the song at anti-gay rallies, and it's also been used to justify racism. On the flip side, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. made his famous mountaintop speech the day before he was killed in 1968, and it ends like this.
Tonight I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
How people relate to patriotism is kind of how they come into the battle hymn.
That's Professor Brigida Johnson, an ethnomusicologist at the University of South Carolina, who teaches in the schools of music and African American studies. After Martin Luther King Jr. died, she says his home church, Ebenezer Baptist, made the song about him and his truth of the civil rights movement. Johnson says this anthem is all about what you bring to it.
For example, when you see your white nationalists kind of digging deep into their heavy patriotism messages, they bring up things like the Star-Spangled Banner and the battle hymn, and it becomes their battle cry just as easy as it could become the battle cry for Ebenezer in Atlanta.
And that flexibility is by design. Quick history. It's the middle of the Civil War. Union soldiers are sitting around a campfire, goofing off, singing songs, and they're ribbing on this one guy.
One of the members of the singing group is a Scottish immigrant named John Brown.
Not that John Brown, says Harvard professor John Stauffer. We're not talking about the famous abolitionist, just a regular soldier. Stauffer is the co-author of the book The Battle Hymn of the Republic, a biography of the song that marches on. He says the soldiers were making up lyrics to the tune of an old hymn, Say Brothers, Will You Meet Us?
So when they start making up songs to pass the time, comrades needle him and say, you can't be John Brown, John Brown's dead. And then another soldier would add, but his body's moldering in the grave.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave.
So even though it's about a regular soldier, the ghost of the abolitionist looms large, and a song called John Brown's Body is born. It becomes super popular among Union soldiers for a few reasons. It's easy to sing, the melody is simple, the lyrics are easy to remember, and most importantly, it glorified the righteous fight against slavery.
The stars of heaven, they are looking kindly down on the grave of old John Brown.
A couple years later, a well-to-do, highly educated poet from New York named Julia Ward Howe comes to Washington, D.C. with her minister to visit Union troops.
As they do so, Confederates attack.
But the Union troops defend and impress Howe. Her minister pushes her to rewrite John Brown's Body.
Rewrite it and elevate it for a kind of educated audience.
John Stauffer says Julie Ward Howe was not interested in creating an anthem. She wanted to make capital A art with metaphor and symbolism so she could join the ranks of the better-known writers of her time.
Symbolism was seen by Hawthorne or Melville, Thoreau, that part of the way in which they were understood as great writers was their use of symbolism.
So Howe ditched many of the crowdsourced lyrics of John Brown's Body, like Let's Hang Jeff Davis from a Sour Apple Tree. But that crowdsourcing is what made the song so popular in the first place. That and the stirring melody of the original hymn. Brigida Johnson says African-American units picked up the melody as their anthem.
You also had this marching song of First Arkansas being sung by black Union soldiers.
We need to show Jeff Davis how the African can fight as we go marching on.
We're done with hoeing cotton, we're done with hoeing corn, we're colored Yankee soldiers now, sure as you're born.
That's folk singer Sparky Rucker again, whose versions of these songs we've been hearing. He says that when he sings the black Union soldiers' version of the song, even in the South, where, in his words, the wounds of the Civil War are still fresh, everyone sings along.
Even a lot of my unreconstructed Southerners in the audience will sing along with me because we've also sung some of their songs.
Singing glory, glory, hallelujah.
Rucker says everyone also sings the Julia Ward Howe version, which eventually won, getting published by The Atlantic Magazine in 1862 and becoming canonized. And while it does transcend centuries and cultures, Brigida Johnson is quick to point out that it is, at the end of the day, a war song. So
the kumbaya moment will not be happening across the aisles because of this song, because it's really about supporting whatever your perspective is on freedom or liberation and having God as the person who's ordaining what we're doing. And glory hallelujah about that.
The song does belong to everyone, as Johnny Cash said in 1969. But what really matters is why they're singing it. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And you can catch Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And join us at 3 for more of the day's news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4. It is a minute before 9 o'clock, and stay with us. Headlines and music are coming up next.
Support for WPR comes from Rogers Behavioral Health in Madison, Appleton, southeastern Wisconsin, and six other states. Dedicated to helping children, teens, and adults find life worth living. More at rogersbh.org.
Support comes from UW Parkside, now offering the Sports Management Master's Degree program. Students learn the business skills necessary to succeed in today's competitive sports environment. Flexible degrees for in-demand careers. More at uwp.edu. You're listening to WGTD HD.